Questions or thank you. Questions or comments? Any on the phone, Felicia?
As a reminder, to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone keypad. That's star 1.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to move to our next topic, which Dr. Bourne is also going to present, stereotactic radiosurgery and stereotactic body radiation therapy. It's a reconsideration that we need to consider. Steve?
Yes, thank you very much. Hope you can hear me. Yes, we have had a reconsideration for allowing the stereotactic radiosurgery added as an indication, or should say choroid melanoma as an indication for stereotactic radiosurgery. As I mentioned previously, because of the new rules about changing or reconsideration of policies, we have to have a formal reconsideration. And the amount of literature that we received and that I could find was not really voluminous, but on the other hand, choroidoid melanomas aren't very common, and to have a very large series of patients wouldn't really be possible. On the positive side, then the papers suggested negative results on patients after use of stereotactic radiosurgery on choroid melanomas, and the outcomes were at least as good as all the other methods. Thus, we felt that we should be able to add choroid melanomas as an indication for stereotactic radiosurgery.
Questions or comments for Dr. Bourne?
As a reminder, to ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. That's star 1.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, thank you.
Next, we're going to go to hypoglossal nerve stimulation for the treatment of obstructive sleep apnea. And in this policy, Lakita, if we could, you're on the slide, that's good. I've listed that we're going to talk about the indications and the limitations and not really the scientific support for it in the interest of time. The covered indications are that it's considered reasonable when the treatment of moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea when all the following criteria are met. And this is really what the FDA approval was for it. Beneficiary needs to be 22 years of age or older. The BMI is less than 35 kilograms per meter squared. And a sleep study is performed within 24 months of the first consultation for implant. And the beneficiary has predominantly obstructive events, that is less than 25% central sleep apnea events. Next slide. Again, the FDA also made this change to make the AHI be down to 15 and up to 65. And this device has been developed for people who cannot tolerate or will not tolerate CPAP. There needs to be absence of complete concentric collapse of the soft palate level on a drug-induced sleep endoscopy procedure. And there needs to be no other anatomical findings that would compromise the performance of the device, like large tonsils and that sort of thing. Next. The limitations that are considered appropriate are the following. It's not been studied to use for any other indication. It needs to be an FDA-approved device. As we said before, the central apnea can't be greater than 25%, and the BMI has to be equal to or greater than 35. I'm not going to read off all of these limitations. Again, the interesting thing about this device is that, for the most part, the studies that are in the literature have the same criteria of eligibility and the same limitations, and many of them are listed on this slide. And we go on to another slide, Lakita. Let's go to the next slide. Well, I mentioned drug-induced sleep endoscopy. This is something that is considered necessary and has been, again, it's been used in the studies once the STAR study developed, and some in some studies before that. And they basically give people propofol and then look to see whether or not the area collapses during breathing. Shared decision making is something that we feel is necessary because this device, although it works for some people, doesn't work for everyone, and we think patients should know ahead of time what those data show. And also, we've included a requirement for a board-certified otolaryngologist with classroom instruction and cadaver training by an FDA-approved technical manufacturer, and the technician needs to be trained on the titration of the device. And we also have certain restrictions on the sleep studies that are in an article that's listed there. Questions or comments? Okay, we're going to go to the first presenter, which is Kathy Sherwood.
Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Sherwood, and if you move on to the next slide, I do have a disclosure. I work for the company. So I lead the market access and reimbursement team, and I'll just begin by saying we are really pleased with this LCD. We are pleased with the new process at Medicare and the fact that we have collaborated to present the evidence, and we feel that this has been a really excellent collaboration between all of the Medicare MACs and industry. So thank you very much for that. Next slide. We have just a couple of comments, and I hate to call these housekeeping, but almost at that level. We're very comfortable with the coverage criteria because, as Dr. Cunningham said, it matches the FDA approval language, and that's exactly as it should be. There's a few things that, as industry, we would like to touch on, and the first is the drug-induced sleep endoscopy training. As we mentioned, industry is going to actually, we do perform both implant training as well as DICE training for any physician who gets certified by the company, and this actually goes into our quality system, which the FDA monitors annually. But we perform that training and certify physicians, so we have a proposal for how to do the drug-induced sleep endoscopy training that we think logistically will be tighter and basically more easy to manage. And then we just have one comment about the device interaction statement, because it actually has been tested and approved by the FDA. This device can be implanted with defibrillators, pacemakers, and everything else. That testing has been performed, so we suggest that maybe that's not an appropriate limitation. Okay, so next slide. So I mentioned the overview of our physician DICE and implant training and certification program. DICE is a subjective test, but it's the best way to tell which patient is really going to be most appropriate for this therapy, because it's taking a deep look at the upper airway anatomy and looking for basically absence of full concentric collapse in that that upper airway. And so we think it's extremely important that physicians are properly trained to do this. And given that it's subjective, we in fact have a module of training that they take along with cadaver training, where the physician will actually perform some DICE, send it up to industry, and then we have a team of physicians that help us review these DICE and basically say, yep, you got it right, or no, you didn't. So that's that second level service. We go to the next slide. Okay, so the current DICE recommendation, or the draft policy, basically says that the physician who would like to become an implanter sends 15 DICE up and with the video clip, and we would do a review of that, and they would need to get 80% of them to match what these experts say, and then that would be documented. And we actually agree with the intent of this. We're good with that. But what we are proposing is that our current training program is to basically do 5 of these. So we're okay with adding an additional 10, but we're proposing that we do that by basically having a pre-recorded group of complex dice that would be performed or basically given to the physician as like a computer-based test as they're doing their cadaver training. So they could do 10 of them where we know what the right answer is, but they're still essentially reviewing that video clip and getting the answer right. If not, then they go back to the drawing board and retrain. And then the last 5 would be consistent with our current training program where they send those in before we give certification. And it is important to note, we will not distribute product. We're the only FDA-approved manufacturer at this point. We will not distribute product to a physician that does not have the certification, because if we get bad outcomes, our company goes out of business. That's the way we look at it. This is critically important that this therapy works and we get the right patients. So, okay, and next slide. And the only other comment that we have here is that there is a statement that says that these implantable devices could experience unintended interaction, and each of the MACs who have posted a positive draft coverage policy has this statement. But in fact, extensive testing was performed. We were actually, our company spun out of Medtronic, and so we had extensive testing performed to validate that, in fact, we do not interfere with other neural stimulators, with defibrillators, pacemakers, and other infusion pumps and that type of thing, which was all submitted to FDA when we got our original PMA approval. So we suggest that maybe that limitation be reconsidered. Okay? Next slide. That's it. Okay.
Questions or comments in the room? On the phone?
As a reminder, to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone keypad. That's star 1.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have a couple of presentations by phone, and the first is Dr. Sooner. Sorry if I mispronounced your name. Are you there? Dr. Egosmith, are you there?
Operator, is that? Okay, all right. Is that Dr. D'Agostino?
Operator, can you check to see if they're on the line? Please.
I don't see that line. What was the first name?
Maria.
Maria Sunara, Suurna.
One moment. Ms. Maria Suurna, you may go ahead.
Can you hear me now? Is that,
yes.
Is everybody, are you able? Okay. So thank you for the opportunity to discuss this LCD and decision. And Dr. D'Agostino and myself, we have the combined slides. We'll address the points together, if that's okay. And I'm with Weill Cornell Medicine. I'm an ENT surgeon who is board certified in otolaryngology and sleep medicine. And Dr. Agustina is with the Middlesex Hospital, and he's also board certified in otolaryngology and sleep medicine. Next slide. We are enrolled in the post-approval clinical trials with Inspire and have received an honoraria from Inspire Medical, mostly for speaking engagements. Next slide, please. So there's a couple aspects that we would like to discuss. One of them actually pertaining to shared decision-making. There is several instances where there is a referral to shared decision making by referring providers, sleep medicine providers, and otolaryngologists or implanters. So that has to be a little bit more qualified in terms of what shared decision making constitutes. Because as otolaryngologists, especially if we're board certified in sleep medicine, we manage patients from the very beginning, like starting with diagnosis of sleep apnea, providing CPAP management, oral appliances, then we manage their CPAP failures, and then in cases where non-surgical treatments fail, we offer surgical procedures and evaluation for surgery. A lot of times patients actually come to us after struggling with CPAP for years or have not used the CPAP, and a lot of times they're sleep medicine physicians were not, like, no longer in the picture. A lot of patients are referred to us, self-referred to us. And so as a otolaryngologist actually well-versed in sleep apnea and management of such, so in terms of getting, like, you know, supportive documentation for sleep physicians or referring providers that might not even be available, and scheduling a consultation with a sleep physician who is not an otolaryngologist, might be more, like, you know, take up more time and actually might not be efficient. And it's also cost inefficient, and also in terms of patient care, it just, again, provides barriers for patient management and treatment of obstructive sleep apnea. So if there is a documentation from primary care physician for referral providers that's available, that's great for medical history completeness. But if all of that can be found from otolaryngologists, notes, and if actually there's a good documentation on CPAP compliance and CPAP trials and failure and discussion of alternatives, then I don't know, I don't see how shared decision should be required. So we would like to consider either removing it or adjusting it so that actually it clarifies and doesn't limit patients' access to the therapy and treatment. Next slide, please. So drug-induced sleep endoscopy, so I know Kathy Sherwood has addressed the details of drug-induced sleep endoscopy. So it's a flexible laryngoscopy while patient is sleeping. So patient is done under sedation. It's a quick procedure. It doesn't really differ much from a technical standpoint as other nasal endoscopies, so laryngoscopies or esophagoscopies that we all perform. And All the endoscopic procedures are basically part of standard laryngologist practice. And I don't see how drug-induced sleep endoscopy actually is that much different in terms of, like, you know, evaluation, like what we're looking for. Yes, there could be like a video, training videos, and could be like a brief instructional sort of course online or provided to us. But I don't see why this procedure has to be very different from other endoscopic procedures that we already perform and requires some extra certification, and especially most of us get exposed to it now in residency since it has become pretty wide available procedure. And I don't think that special certification should be required, especially by the manufacturer, because, again, people from a manufacturing standpoint, they are not physicians. And so in some of the procedures, like, you know, endoscopic procedures, and then also in terms of training, I think, like, we get trained in residency, and I don't see that excessive certification should be indicated, because, again, that drug-induced sleep endoscopy, it is not, from technical standpoint, much different from what we already do. Next slide, please. Can I also request, Dr. DeGustino is actually also on the call, and I don't think his line is open. Is it possible to open his line as well? And his number is 860-2807-235. Is that something that's doable?
Operator, can you assist with that, please?
Yes, ma'am. One moment.
So he can also participate in this call. Well, So while Dr. D'Agostino is joining, I'll proceed to the next point then, if that's okay. So the other proposed indication is, like, undercovered indications, is that the anatomic findings, specifically focusing on tonsils size 3 and 4, based on the tonsil hypertrophy grading. Well, that should not be contraindication because some of that could be subjective, and again, there's no evidence that tonsil hypertrophy is contraindicated for hypo loss of nerve stimulation, and it actually can significantly alter the outcomes. For example, some people actually can have tonsil hypertrophy that's transient due to inflammatory process or respiratory infection. So I would suggest that to leave that up to the implanters, and again, we do evaluate anatomy on a routine basis, and I don't think that this type of anatomic consideration should be considered as a contraindication to the device or to the implant or to the therapy. So we suggest to consider removing it. Next slide. So the other aspects of being discussed are limitations, and there are several limitations that were listed, but specifically the ones that we wanted to make sure that they're clearly addressed or modified is, like, for example, active psychiatric disease, which, again, what is defined as active psychiatric disease? Is that depression, anxiety, which often are exacerbated by sleep deprivation and sleep apnea? And that should be, like, you know, patients are well managed and properly treated with, like, anxiety or antidepressant medications. They should be candidates for this therapy, as well as there is association with untreated sleep apnea and development of anxiety and depression, for example. So, again, that should be clarified. And neuromuscular disease, again, that should be more specified, a little bit more, in more detail, what's considered neuromuscular disease. For example, like in the peripheral neuropathy, sciatica, like foot drop, some of the neuromuscular disorders that contribute to the neuromuscular tone issue, like, for example, in Down syndrome patients. I mean, all of those things can be great candidates for patients to still continue with the therapy, so that needs to be addressed and adjusted to reflect what type of specific neuromuscular disorders we are discussing. Also, uncontrolled hypertension, again, that needs to be qualified, kind of quantified, what is considered uncontrolled hypertension, because, again, a lot of patients have poorly controlled hypertension due to untreated sleep apnea, and then that should not be necessarily a limitation for implantation. There's also another subject that's not on the list when it comes to pregnancy. The device is not unsafe in pregnancy, so I think it's a surgical procedure that patients who are pregnant or expecting to become pregnant within, like, you know, like next few months or so, that sort of, like, you know, should not be getting surgery during that time. That should be considered. But again, in terms of the device being unsafe in pregnancy, that should not be stated as such. To the next, Mark, are you there?
Am I on? We've been trying to get on the whole call.
Can you
hear me?
Okay. So, Mark, do you have any comments on anything that I've gone through? So, like, before we proceed with the next one.
I just wanted to reiterate what you said about the shared decision making. I think that should be made between the physician and the patient, as opposed to a referring provider. As you mentioned, Dr. Serna, most of the referring providers are not as familiar with this procedure or the indications or qualifications for it as we are. And a lot of these patients come to us as the primary modality of treatment. And as we are doing CPAP ourselves and trying to get these patients to use CPAP, if they are failures, we're trying to offer them another service and to try to get approval from a referring physician who may be totally unfamiliar with the patient or their situation or the actual procedure itself, I think is uncalled for. And then the second indication I wanted to make or comment was about the drug-induced sleep endoscopy, as Dr. Turner had said. I mean, we were doing drug-induced sleep endoscopy long before Inspire came along, just as much as we do nasal endoscopy and other procedures in our field. So, I mean, it seems a little redundant or strange to have industry certify us on a diagnostic procedure that we're already doing. And I agree what you said as far as the anatomical requirements and where you are on this current slide, Dr. Serna. So if you want to continue, sorry to interrupt you.
Okay. So the next recommendation is It's about the device model 3024. That's just basically irrelevant because I don't think this model is longer available. It's no longer on the market. We're no longer implanting this model, so that should be removed. Next slide. So the next one is talking about qualified physician who is board certified otolaryngologist, complete the appropriate AMA or AOA certified residency and fellowship program, and maintain ongoing certification in otolaryngology. So this needs to be modified. It should be board certified or board eligible otolaryngologist because physicians have to be at least for a year in practice before they take their board. So young physicians should be able to have the opportunity to offer this therapy within their first year of after training. And the other thing is that we don't usually, there's no fellowship training for this. So residency in otolaryngology and completion of residency should be sufficient to qualify for this type of procedure. Next slide. Surgeons need to receive classroom instructions by FDA-approved device manufacturer or equivalent on device implant techniques as well as cadaver training. So initially, yes, the cadaver training was essential when the procedure was first developed, but now since we're doing it more and more and a lot more residents are getting exposed to this in their residency training, if there is a significant training in the residency, I'm not sure if cadaver training should be mandatory for all of the physicians, especially when they actually had, like, you know, already done or observed or participated in, like, at least, like, you know, I don't know, 5 to 10 implants. So should some modification be made for hypoglossal nerve stimulation implants if they were available in residency or fellowship?
I agree. If I may join in there, Dr. Serna, I think that, you know, this is a procedure that involves a part of the anatomy or part of the neck that we are in all the time for head and neck cancers and removing salivary glands and whatnot. And so anybody board certified in otolaryngology should be very well familiar with this anatomy in this area, the nerve itself. And other than the industry training on the actual device and how to put the cuff around the nerve, I'm not so sure that cadaver training would be necessary for somebody that's already well versed in this anatomy.
Nice. Next slide. So the next one is the evaluation referral and post-implant evaluation of hypoglossal nerve stimulator, but not excluding effective post-operative care by internal physician, should be performed by board-eligible or board-certified sleep physician with qualifications as outlined. So that's then visual sleep technicians. And then also sleep studies should be performed in an accredited sleep study facility as stated in the article. So we basically suggest that should be performed by a physician qualified to treat patients with a sleep disorder, not necessarily stating like no certified sleep physician. Because again, as a otolaryngologist, especially as implanters, we do manage patients and we do prescribe, set them up with the sleep studies, and we do activate a device, we do adjust the device. So a lot of times if otolaryngologists are comfortable and available, and again, should be the primary, should be, I guess not necessarily primary, but should be available and to provide this type of care. And a lot of times we're the first ones to actually initiate and deal with this therapy. And the same way when we're talking about in the sleep study in the facility, yes, in certain situations, in the lab, sleep study should be done for patients to evaluate their therapy effectiveness. But in a lot of situations, we can actually evaluate patients with a home testing, especially when it's in terms of, like, you know, following up, like a long-term follow-up, and after the settings adjustments, and just looking at the effectiveness of therapy. In many circumstances, we don't need to have, like, mandate to have a sleep study performed in a sleep facility. Mark, Dr. Degustin, do you have any comments?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, the titration study needs to be done in the lab, but following these patients with a home study is very appropriate. And in addition, you know, I think there's two models that we see with the Inspire therapy. I think there's the model where the otolaryngologist or the sleep certified otolaryngologist is very comfortable with this and handling the patient and managing them and controlling it. And I think there's a model in some centers where the internal medicine sleep physicians are very involved, and they will refer the patient for implantation, and then they'll see the patient back to manage them or to titrate them. So I think to be restrictive in the wording as to who's going to follow up and take care of the patients is not appropriate. I think that it should read that, by a qualified physician in handling the sleep patient, whether that is a board-certified sleep physician or a board-certified sleep otolaryngology physician.
I think that's our last slide. So was this,
Thank you. Are there questions or comments? On the phone.
As a reminder, to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone keypad. That's star and the number 1.
Thank you very much. We now are going to move to our next policy, which is salvage high-intensity focused ultrasound treatment in prostate cancer. Dr. Howe is going to present.
Yes, good afternoon. Can you hear me okay?
We can, Craig.
Okay. So this is a new policy titled Salvage High-Intensity Focused Ultrasound, HIFU for short, treatment in prostate cancer. The salvage denotes we're talking about treatment after recurrence, after primary therapy. And so the reason for this procedure is that a certain amount of patients whose primary treatment is radiotherapy relapse, and it's about half of those patients, and about a quarter relapse in a localized fashion, and this relapse can impact mortality. There's no standard of care for such patients currently, although radical prostatectomy is probably the most accepted. There's interest in potentially less invasive alternatives such as brachytherapy, cryoablation, and HIFU, which is, again, the subject of this policy. Next slide. HIFU is an energy-based, minimally invasive, ablative treatment. A transrectal ultrasound probe is placed with which both images the prostate and delivers the bursts of heat to create coagulation necrosis in that targeted area identified by the ultrasound. And there's a surrounding cooling balloon that protects the rectal mucosa from the high temperature. It's done as an outpatient under spinal or general anesthesia. And next slide. Results are generally similar between HIFU and radical prostatectomy, with perhaps the data we have showing perhaps more urinary incontinence and erectile dysfunction after radical prostatectomy. Next slide. So in summary, there's no level one data. All the data is, there are several observational studies, some are prospective, some are retrospective, almost all are non-comparative and relatively small with short follow-up and non-standardized outcome measures. On the other hand, while of low quality, the data is cumulatively moderate in size and generally consistently positive. If you look at the various guidelines nationally and internationally, the recommendations span the continuum from saying there's equal results with radical prostatectomy, so parity, to relegation to experimental status. Basically, all the guidelines do recommend or endorse radical prostatectomy. So we took the compromise position of limiting salvage HIFU to high comorbidity patients that would otherwise be eligible for radical prostatectomy. Next slide. I'm not going to go over these, but suffice it to say that they generally outline the criteria to be a candidate for salvage radical prostatectomy, except for number five, that high comorbidity, i.e. not a candidate for radical prostatectomy that I just outlined. So, as I said, who otherwise would be a candidate except for that? And these are generally accepted criteria for salvage radical prostatectomy. I think that's it. Any questions?
I don't see any in the room. Are there any on the phone, operator?
Again, in order to ask a question, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. That's star and the number 1.
Okay, thank you. Next we have Mr. Embert, or is it Dr. Embert?
No, Mr. Thank you. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to discuss with you salvage HIFU for the treatment of prostate cancer. Hope everyone hears me well on the phone.
Can you hear in the back?
Despite the accent, sorry. I'm an employee of one of the manufacturers of HIFU devices, so that's my conflict of interest, obviously. What I would like to do is present quickly the HIFU technology and the current clinical evidence in the treatment of prostate cancer that led to this LCD, but also I want to discuss this draft article for HIFU, the salvage therapy, and the potential negative impact that could have on the coverage of HIFU for other indications, in particular primary prostate cancer. Next slide. The principle of HIFU has been explained. It works a bit like a magnifying glass with the rays of the sun that focuses the rays of the sun to burn a leaf. We do exactly the same. We generate ultrasound that we focus on a point to elevate the temperature and create a coagulation necrosis, so burn basically remotely tissue. So we do this through the rectal wall, so it's a completely non-invasive procedure. So instead of opening to take the prostate out, we can focus the ray of the sun to destroy a part of the prostate where the tumor is located. Next slide.